You have just heard we are reading from 1 Corinthians 11. Verse number 1. Be ye followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Now I praise you, brethren, that ye remember me in all things, and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head. But every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered, dishonoreth her head, for that is even all one as if she were shaven. For if the woman be not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, but as much as he is the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of the man. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. For as the woman is of the man, even so is the man also by the woman, but all things are of God. Judge in yourselves. Is it comely for a woman pray unto God, that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. Now in this that I declare unto you, I praise you not, that ye come together, not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when ye come together in the church, I hear that there be divisions among you, and I partly believe it. For there must be also heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest among you. When ye come together therefore unto one place, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating every one taketh before the other his own supper, and one is hungry, and another is drunken. What? Have ye not houses to eat and drink in? Or despise ye the church of God, and shame them that have not? What shall I say unto you? Shall I praise you in this? I praise you not. For I have received of the Lord that which also I delivered unto you, that the Lord Jesus, the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he brake it and said, Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me. After the same manner also he took the cup, when he had supped, saying, This is the cup of the New Testament in my blood. This do ye, as oft as ye drink it, in remembrance of me. For as often as ye eat this bread, and drink this cup, ye do show the Lord's death till he come. Wherefore, whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily, shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For he that eateth and drinketh unworthily eateth and drinketh damnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this cause many are weak and sickly among you, and many sleep. But we would judge ourselves. But if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. But when we are judged, we are chastened of the Lord, that we should not be condemned with the world. Wherefore, my brother, when you come together to eat, tarry one for another. And if any man hunger, let him eat at home, that ye come not together unto condemnation. And the rest will I set in order when I come. There are two major problems in taking a Bible reading on the passage that we have read. And the first is, of course, that it's very extensive and could extend to not only 2 hours, but 4 to give it proper attention. So that will mean we'll have to slip through it fairly quickly. And the second is, it's so often dealt with in meetings of one form or another not, there's little can be said about it that hasn't already been said, so that we might go home more or less confirmed in what we believe, rather than receiving fresh revelation. Now, I think all have agreed, as they read through the first epistle to the Corinthians, that what our dear brother said, Mr. Condit said, I think way back years ago, he says, when I look at 1 Corinthians, I think of a well-ordered garden, everything in its right place, and everything set in its proper order. And you can't deny the fact that he has kept a very careful, you might say, plan as regards the epistle. He deals with divisions first, you see, because you can't do anything in by way of discipline until you have a united assembly. And then he goes to discipline, as I hinted at. Then he goes to public testimony. And then he deals with matters that have to do with what we would call liberty, and goes right through that in several chapters. And of course, without going too far into the detail with those chapters, we come to the one that we're going to consider now. It has to do with the coming together of the saints of God. Now, I know that some think that we haven't the collective gathering until we get to further down, where we have the whole church come together in one place. My own personal view, I know it's not the same as others on the platform, but my own personal view is that he has already dealt with the home line of things, and the matter of how to act in the home, in entertainment and so on, or being entertained in connection with idolatry and so on. But when he comes to this, I thought he has reached that point where he's moving into those collective gatherings of the saints, which we call coming into in church capacity. And that's instruction for that. In doing this, of course, he touches on the demeanor of the saints, their behavior, and how they're to be addressed and so on. We deal with that in the first part of the chapter. Then he touches the second great point, and that is the divisions that were amongst them because of their lack of consideration one for the other. And when he is done with that, he gives them the declaration that the Lord had given him relative to the Lord's Supper, and gives us what we know to be likely the first recorded record, the first of the many times that this supper is mentioned. I know that it's very specially developed in Luke's Gospel, and you have it in Mark and other places, in Matthew and other places, but we don't want to go into that. What we do want us to see is that the Lord apparently gave Paul a very special revelation of this supper, and told him the details, and he has put them down. And the first readings of that great matter were in this very letter. Now, as to the difficulties, there might be few. You needn't be a bit afraid. Plenty of them, as old as myself and a good bit older. So we'll likely not solve them all. We come, of course, the first verse, I think we'll not spend much time at it, because actually it really belongs to the previous chapter, and it has to do with Paul as to be imitated, just as he had imitated Christ, and that was in the matter of the consideration of others. Now we come to our chapter 11, and we find that the apostle is beginning now to think of what an assembly is like when it gathers together. There's one thing you can easily see, that there will be no difficulty in a church in the New Testament times of distinguishing between men and women. The sects are very distinctly evident in the meeting. Now, all of us know that that's the great thing that's being opposed in the world today. They try to make their clothes alike, they try to dress them alike, and they try to make as little distinction, noticeably, between the two parts of humanity. They do that with great effort at the present time. But in God's church, just as in God's creation, things are left as they should be. And that's what we have to look at in the early part. You'll notice that we're introduced to the subject of headship. That is to say, we are seen that the head of every woman is a man. Now, I don't think here we're husband and wife. Now, please, I hope we'll all be reading that. I hope we won't have too many difficulties on the platform. I don't take this to be husband and wife. Those who take it to be husband and wife think that single girls shouldn't wear a head covering in meetings. Well, you didn't know that. And it's only married people should wear a head covering. Now, I don't believe that. So that clears that a hope away out of the road. What we're thinking of is just man and woman. Then again, I think we should be very clear in our minds that there are three statements relative to headship. There's the woman and the man's the head of the woman, and then Christ is the head of the man, and then God is the head of Christ. Now you must not think that the measurement between those are the same, because it's very different to think of the headship of Christ and God and the headship of man and woman. They're very different. But in this sense now, you say, what is the headship? I take it it's control. It's that authority that's suggested in the passage. And that is, you say, but how, in what sense was Christ under control of God? The head of Christ is God. Well, I take it that is quite clear in our New Testament, the relationship between the persons of the Godhead, that the Son is ever seen, even apart from his humanity, as a submissive one. Gladly submissive. No inferiority now. Don't misunderstand it. No inferiority, but absolute delight in doing the Father's will. So it's the Father sent the Son. And of course, we used to hear often in Thanksgiving, he came as willingly as he was sent. But the delight of the Father's will is the portion of the Son. At the same time, God is the head in that respect. He is the one who controls. Now, when we come to man and woman, we find that the apostle deals with it very, very simply. So that if you came into a church, in Paul's mind, you'd have no difficulty knowing that's a woman and that's a man. And he speaks of the fact that there's a symbol connected with that headship. And that headship is the covering of the woman's head. And he says, now, if a man were to cover his head, of course, he would be just acting like a woman. And he would be losing the place that God has meant him to be in. And if a woman were to be uncover her head, she would be taking the place of a man. And that is a shameful thing for her to do. And then he brings into that, we might say, as a sideline, to more or less emphasize it, and that is the question of hair. Because he can see that it was normal in those days that women would have long hair. And that long hair, of course, would cover their shoulders or cover their neck and so on. Now, he speaks of that in keeping with the fact that they cover their head. Now, I know that some have been in difficulty with the expression, his head, is it verse 3 or so, in the chapter, praying or prophesying, no, verse, yes, with his head, and they wonder, is the head Christ or his own head? I have no doubt, whatever, mind you, no doubt. Nobody need try to change me on that. That is the man's own head. It's nothing to do with Christ. Because the next part goes to show that it's the woman's head and there's nothing to do with the man. Now get that clear. There's no doubt about that. That's not important in the Bible. So we needn't be getting our heads in confusion over that. His head's his own head. His physical head. And nothing else. It's no reference whatever to Christ. And her head is no reference whatever to man. Now then, he lets us see that in those days. Now, this is not a chapter now teaching the women not to cut their hair. It's taken for granted that no woman would ever think of doing that. That's a wee bit different. Never dreamt of it that anybody would ever think of cutting their hair. Because, you see, that's her glory. And she should be very happy to wear that. And to keep it. Because she can't part with it. It's her glory. And, of course, Paul never even thinks of such a thing as her shaving her hair. Because a woman had did that. A woman who had her hair shown, she was in disgrace. And she was ashamed. And that's what they did sometimes to punish the unfaithful, or in some way or other, it was something to indicate that things were not normal in her case. Now I think we can get that far. Then again, we don't want to go into that in too much in detail. We need to notice before we leave it that there are two words for covering here in this passage. You might have noticed in my remarks I distinguished them without saying so. But there's the ordinary word for covering. Now, it's not covering hair now. Because my hair covers my head, whatever I have, but it covers my head just as much as my heart. But it's something that can be taken off and put on. uncovered or covered. Don't go but talking about the hair being the covering. Well, that's not what answers so many men. You missed your Bible. No, I didn't miss my Bible. It said later down, for hair is given her for a covering. Now, that's a different word. That's something that hangs around loose, as it were, something that hangs around her. So that is a mantle, as we would say. And that is nothing. People say, well, sure, I have my hair. I don't need any cut on me. I don't need any covering on me. I don't need any veil on me. I have my hair. But you see, that's not the idea. The idea is this, that if a woman is naturally wearing that which covers her neck and shoulders, long hair that God has given her, or God given to her, if she has that, it's no great burden then to put the extra covering on, the veil or the hat or whatever you may be, to cover her hair. And that's simply the reason why the long hair and short hair is brought into the passage. Now we must leave that. Coming quickly to the next section, I will not say too much about it. He visualizes not only their coming in and their demeanor as they do so, but he thinks them again of how they were acting when they did come together. And this is dealing with more or less the social side of things. Because, you see, they came together to eat together. And to eat, but then the trouble was that some, they had their meal eaten before the others came in. And they were making a kind of common meal. And then at the same time, introducing the Lord's Supper. And that, he says, you just can't do. You just can't behave like this and eat the Lord's Supper. You just cannot do that. The poor, not getting anything to eat, would feel grieved at the others overeating and some even overdrinking and becoming drunk. That is the great point in that little section there. That is a fairly important section. Is to divide for all time a common meal and the Lord's Supper. Now we want to get that very clear, that it's just not an ordinary meat. It must be distinct from an ordinary meat. Now you know in many of our assemblies years gone by that people had their lunch after the breaking of bread, and in many places they couldn't go home, and here in America quite often after the members' meeting the meal would have to be provided for people too far distant to get back for the next meeting. That's all, yes, but in no way is that to be mingled with the Lord's Supper, or confused with it. Now we come to what I suppose most will think is the most important part, and that is Paul, he says now, I'm going to disclose things to you. And he's going to outline again. Now he told them in the early part of the chapter that they did keep the traditions. The traditions, of course, are the directly communicated messages that were brought to them. Now he says, I'm going to declare it again, what was delivered to me. I got a special, I judge, revelation of the Lord's Supper, and I'm going to tell you now exactly how it took place and how it was arranged. He says, yes, the night in which the Lord was being betrayed. That is just at the very time when the betrayal was all and that delivering up was all being planned. The Lord Jesus gathered his own around. Now, if there's nothing else in the passage, that's your sober. There was no light moment in the Lord's life. There never were any light moments, but was certainly one of the heaviest that he ever faced. Now let us think of that when we sit there to remember the Lord. Then again, you notice that he introduces what we have all known so well, the two emblems, and it shows that these are symbol of the Lord's blood and of his body. Now remember, it's not the breaking of the bread that illustrates his death, because the blood and the body being severed by the two symbols demonstrates death apart from the breaking altogether. But when it comes to the breaking, it's my sharing and taking my portion of that bread. And when it comes to the drinking, it's my sharing and taking a portion of that cup. So that the real meaning of it is this, that when I remember the Lord, I do it in memory of one who died for me. And we could easily say, the lines of the hymn, it was for me, yes, all for me, as we take the emblems from Lord's Day to Lord's Day. Now, of all the things in our Bible that have been confused by men and have been changed by man, there's nothing has been more altered than the simple remembrance of the Lord. As you know, the Roman Catholics have turned it into the Mass. And in the many religious systems, it's turned into a kind of once in 3 months or once in 6 months, what they call communion, and to use all these words and verses. And it's very far from, and even unsaved and all, taking part in it, and so on. Very distinct from what we know of in its simplicity. Then in assemblies, of course, they have turned it into a worship meeting. They tell you you come there to give, and you don't come there to get. And they have made a whole big song of that, and upset many assemblies along that line, not knowing that you're there to remember the Lord. And you're there to proclaim His death, to preach His death. So men say, well, you can't preach at the Lord's Supper anymore. The very thing the Bible says you should have is the very thing they don't want. You proclaim the Lord. Now that word proclaim is never used in a figurative sense. It's always announced and publicly declared so that no one even comes in to see will be in any doubt as to what we're doing. We're publicly declaring, we're telling the people, we're remembering the Lord's body and the Lord's death. And we're sharing in that, and so on. That is God's great intention. Then again, the last part, and we'll have to close, the last part is dealing with the possibility of partaking of the supper in an unworthy fashion. That is just to eat those emblems and drink that, or eat and drink those emblems, just as if it was an ordinary meal, without realizing what's symbolizing. And without realizing the seriousness of it. Now, evidently, some of Corinth had done that. And the chastening hand of God had been laid upon them. Therefore, some were sick, and some were sick, and some had passed away, even had fallen asleep. The Lord had taken them away. They had abused the holy privilege of remembering the Lord. So I hope all of us who gather to remember the Lord, I hope you realize its solemnity. Well, says somebody, what could preserve me? He says, let a man examine himself. I don't know whether any of you have noticed, I'm sure most of you have, but I don't think there's anywhere in our New Testament when we have such a group of words dealing with judgment and condemnation and chastisement and so on, as you have in those few verses at the end. All but one, I think, with the one root base behind it, the word judge. And he says now, you have to discern the Lord's body, you have to, sure to detect and discern the Lord's body and blood. But you have to give yourself a proof before you go. Just examine yourself. You know, I like that. I know I might be going a wee bit figurative now, but I know if you want to look at something very precious, if you look at something the very opposite, it helps you to value it. Doesn't it? The darkness helps you to value the lightness. The brightness. Take a look at yourself. Before you sit at the Lord's table, just take a look at yourself. Wouldn't it make you shudder to think? A piece of fallen humanity wrapped up in skin, gold of head part, remembering the Lord of glory. Examine yourself. And then he says, so let them eat. That would be the right frame of mind to come in, to sit down, to remember the Lord. And then, following that, he goes on to show that we handle those emblems reverently. Now they're not transformed. There's nothing happens to them. They're just simply bread and simply wine. And when the meeting's over, they're still bread and they're still wine. But in taking them, we take them as symbols of the body and blood of Christ. And we do so, and we judge ourselves. But if we would fail to do that, we would be judged. And then to close the thing up, he says, now, I'm going to emphasize again what he has said further up the chapter, ye houses to eat and drink. Look, brother, there are things that are all right in the home. Don't bring them into the assembly. Understood? Nothing wrong with eating and drinking. Many other things, there's nothing wrong with it, for the home, not for the assembly. So he says, ye have houses to eat and drink in, and don't you be spoiling using the church of God, the house of God, or the church of God for a purpose it was never intended. Now the modern thing, and I've said a few things, maybe startling things, but I hope not, and I hope you'll be able to contribute, because many of our dear brethren who would normally contribute, I must admit, I feel rather sad today. Very sorry of parting with our dear brother, Mr. Hawker. I'm sorry about that, I didn't say that too far. We're sorry Mr. McGray's not here, who often contributed in these days. And Mr. Turtleton, another brother, is not able to be here. So please do your best, brethren, to help the Bible reading, because we miss these good men.
And for sure they're not able to be healed by it.
For sure not there.
First, I don't think we should maybe be unduly concerned about it. Paul has given an example of his own conduct. He's given offense neither to the Jew nor Greek, nor to the Gentile in verse 32 of chapter 10. And he says, be imitators of me, even as I also am of Christ. That is, he's given them, himself as a pattern to be imitated. And he also realizes that his pattern is simply the reproduction of a greater pattern than any that is the Lord himself. Now we could maybe move to verse 2 because I don't think we are intending to go back at all into chapter 10. Thank you, brother. Yes, that is perfectly true. And it's nice to see that in verse 2, he says, I praise you. And then when he goes further down the chapter, he says, in this I praise you not. So that there are times when you can praise the Christians, and there are times when you just can't. If they're not doing what's right, you just can't praise them for it, even though willing you'd be glad to do so.
In chapter 1, he seems to give God thanks for what he has enriched them with.
Mm-hmm.
But here, and he must have found it very difficult, he found something to praise about the Corinthians. In writing to other Christians, he could say, I thank God upon every remembrance of you. But to think about the Corinthians on a whole, it brought tears to his eyes. But here he finds something he can praise them for.
Yes. And that which he praises them for is that they are keeping the ordinances which he delivered unto them. Now, the word ordinances, I take it to refer to that oral teaching that he had given while among them. And while there were failings at Corinth, we mustn't wipe the assembly all down, you know, by the failings that we've been taught in it. There must have been many dear souls in Corinth who did strictly keep to Paul's teaching and give him cause for rejoicing. There's an old portable thing this time.
Just in connection with what you're saying, with this commendation, I know the writers and so on leave out the word rather in verse 2, but the atmosphere is there, and then the end of the chapter, verse 33, wherefore my brethren,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned, most of the chapter is corrected, and yet it's all written in an attitude, atmosphere of affection.
Mm-hmm.
And even all the problems of Corinth, Paul referred to them as brethren more often than he did any other assembly.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, yes.
It is that here they demand divisions. I assume that they are referring doctrinally apart from the chapter 15.
Mm-hmm.
That fit in with.
Yes, yes, but I think that the point is that when a man has planted an assembly, now let us be sensible, brethren, even a missionary has planted an assembly, he has to give very simple and plain instructions as to assembly life. He doesn't bring the Christians, those young believers, into some great big knowledge of stuff that they can't swallow, but he does teach them ordinary practical things. And I take it that Paul, with it, in an oral way, in an ordinary way, just speaking the same as we're speaking here, he spoke to the Christians at Corinth. And they remembered him. They didn't merely let it in and then out again, but they kept retaining that and still practiced what he had enjoined them to do.
So this would relate both to matters of faith and also practice.
I thought so. Yes. I thought particularly maybe practice. It may not be always that, but I thought that it was a great thing, you know, to sit at Paul's feet and learn from him and to be remembering what he had taught them. You remember he does that very same thing with Timothy, keeping him in remembrance. He wants us to remember these things.
Is this praising of the saints in Corinth and the manifesting of his love for them in order that there might be producing them a ready response to the correctiveness?
Well, we generally take that view that where if you start off too sharp sometimes with Christians, you could turn the edge from them and they just wouldn't take any. The subject of headship in verse 3. And we have three spheres of it, as I've already pointed out. Well, you see, that would get me back to Mr. Condick's point. The gradual working. You see, he's been taking a look at the assembly, and then he's looked at the visions, and he has seen them now carrying out discipline. That's all internal. Then he goes to the law courts. That's into public life. And then he touches those things that we might say could be rightly or wrongly used. And that gets you that. Now his mind is turning to the collective thing and to the assembly thing. And the big principle he wants to emphasize before you get right started, the very first thing that you'd notice when you go into a Corinthian assembly, those are women and those are men.
We could nearly learn how to teach here. He establishes the principle of headship, and he sees this to be acknowledged and demonstrated in the assembly where the Lordship of Christ is on.
We realize, of course, that Paul is addressing the assembly at Corinth. In other words, he's addressing those who were believers. But is this truth of headship creatorial? Does it extend wider than simply relating to believers?
That is one of the major questions that has to be answered. Is this a creatorial thing, or is it a spiritual thing? I take it that in a broad sense, without even Paul maybe narrowing it too much, he must have a very wide thing, because he goes back to creation. He doesn't go back to the redemption. So that headship is something that began with Adam and Eve.
So, in other words, it is a wider thing, we judge, although, of course, it would only be recognized by those who are believers.
Yes.
James could say we are unto God as a kind of first fruits. The assembly and the Christian should be given to God that which creation will yet yield them, everything in divine order and submission to God.
The reigning order
in
creation, the time that in the church, and the reigning order in the church.
Well, yes, because you won't get praying and prophesying in the work. You understand, this is something that has to do with the assembly.
And we are not really on the problem yet, but the connection with the later verse of generalism. We'll have to read this into it, and it's very hard to get our money. What do you think exactly was the problem for Corinth? Were some of the brethren covering their heads? Or did the main problem lie with the behavior of some of the women folk? I'm not asking that prostitutes to pay notice to it, that we can see where the difficulty lies.
Yes. Well, I didn't see that he's doing a rebuke here for either. I think he's stating a fact. Now, I was going to say a meeting begins at all, there are certain principles that are obtaining.
You didn't think
that some of the women were coming in uncovered.
I was wondering that some of the women haven't heard about equality and salvation. They heard from a passage like Galatians, maybe not.
Yes.
That there's neither male nor female, that they grasp the conclusion that we are equal with the men. We can do what the men do now in Christ. We don't need any of these decisions, and they were exploiting their new Christian liberty to take things that...
Uh-huh. Well, that, of course, liberty, as you know, goes back to the previous chapters. As you, that makes the link between the two. But there's no great condemnation in the chapter of what they've been doing. That's one of the things that... He's not condemning them for what they have done. He's not telling them that you didn't do that. But...
Is another suggestion in verse number 15 that there might be some resistance to this teaching?
16.
Verse 16. Yes. Yes, but you see, I have thought that he had tried to show the reasonableness of women being covered by with a head covering because they already are covered with hair.
Well,
So it would not be a big thing. It's only another step in the same direction.
I was going to ask you this, Shane. In regard to the first 16 verses of the chapter, they seem to be taken up fairly exclusively with the subject of headship. But then when you get to the last half of the chapter, lordship seems to be emphasized. The Lord is mentioned something like 8 times. And I'm wondering, is there any particular distinction between headship and lordship? Now, I'm aware of what you said in your introduction about headship being desired to be regarded. But I would really like some help. Is there any significant difference between headship and lordship?
Well, now, it would hardly be wise, I think, to say that God is the Lord of Christ. You want to be careful, brother. I can't, maybe our brother doesn't see that. I can't see that you could readily say that. So that I can say that God is the head of Christ, showing us that he is the controlling influence. But lordship has to do with a supremacy that I don't think is in headship. Would that be helpful?
Yes.
Some use this passage as liberty on the sisters taking part, saying that it is not an assembly of gather. But you have said it is, and I agree. Could you clarify that a little bit for us, please?
Well, as you know, the difficulty is, nobody doubts that, and Brother has hinted this coming, and that is to say how you can get women praying or prophesying in a local assembly. The old answer to that used to be, and with Moses' heart to beat maybe yet, and that is that Paul deals with one evil at one trouble at one time, and that he's not dealing with the question of who can do it at this point, but he will correct that in chapter 14. In other words, he treats each difficulty as he comes to it. That's the usual way of overcoming that. But I think that I think now that there is a sense in which you can't deny the fact that it's not a women's meeting and it's not a man's meeting. Your scripture for a man's meeting, as you all know, but you haven't any scripture for a women's meeting that I know of.
Could we bring anything more into it than it's the two exercises of the saints when they come together in praying or speaking to God, and in prophesying it's speaking to the each other?
Yes, by direct revelation, yes.
If it was just the individual that was engaged in prayer, well, we're told later she's not praying, so she wouldn't need to be covered. But I judge it's to characterize the company when they're met together in communion with God or in testimony to men, the women are to have their head covered.
Mm-hmm. I think you're...
Go ahead, you take a different view, don't you? Now? Go ahead.
That's all right. I was going to say, I think you're aware of the fact that I take a different view. Yes, so, I take the view that verses 2 to 16 are wider, and I'm genuinely interested in your response to this question with regard, say, to women prophesying. And I'm thinking of Philip's four virgin daughters. Would you think that when they prophesied, they actually had their heads covered?
I see what you mean.
I think we ought to be frank and open about this, because these are the questions that younger people are asking. You know, they say, well, you know, what about these women who prophesied? And we say, well, if you go back to Acts chapter 21, it's evident that it's the home sphere.
Yes, that's right.
And I take it that when they prophesied, it would be appropriate for them, therefore, to have their head covered. Now, I think we would all say amen to that, wouldn't we?
Yes, but that wouldn't, of course, change when we come to the assembly. You wouldn't want to see them uncovered in the assembly.
You've already alluded to the fact that we have repeated reference from verse 17 onwards of this idea of when ye come together, when ye be in assembly. And that's one of the reasons why I take it that this earlier part of the chapter is wider. You said it's creatorial, and I think it's wider.
The one thing that, of course, everyone would be interested in, for instance, a man and his wife praying together in the home, which is, I hope, normal for all of us, should she cover her head during that time?
I would judge that if the woman is praying, and I see nothing wrong personally in a wife audibly praying in the presence of her husband. That's my own personal feeling. And I'll just be quite perfectly frank. This is just what my wife and I do. And my wife, when she prays, she covers her head. That's just how she feels. She feels uncovered if she doesn't...
You see, well, look at the thing very simply now. For instance, some of her dear brethren call into hospital, and they visit a sister in the hospital, and they pray. Should she get her head covered while they're praying? Do you brethren always find them wishing for covering their head?
No, I'm saying that when the woman is praying audibly,
yes,
that's what I'm saying.
Well, now, have you...
Later we'll notice there's a big difference between the assembly and the whole, because the women are to keep silent in the church. But if she will learn anything, let her ask her own husband at home. She's perfectly at liberty to speak, and I think the sisters can use that liberty quite well. And it would do their husbands well if they did ask these questions, what they could do it at home.
The difficulty I would have, Father David, is in verse 16, where we have reference to the practice of all the churches. It seems to apply to the verses that have gone before, and I would take it that this the verses in regard to headship here is in relation to the local assembly. As our brother McShane mentioned, it's not the husband and wife here, it's rather the man and the woman.
I agree.
Something else I would like to say, because we are still on verse 3, I think it, where you mentioned three mentions of headship. Do we have here, first of all, headship and subjection without equality? That is Christ and the man. And then headship and subjection with equality, that's the man and the woman. And then headship in equality, that's God and Christ. Now I make a difference of with equality, because although that's the divine intention, it is possible that the man acts or the woman acts in ways that do not show equality. When we come to the last expression, inequality, there's perfect, unchanging equality when it comes to headship and subjection with God.
And that's it, that's it.
There is righteousness for the sheep. With Roger, he takes the first 16 verses as a regularity in the assembly, and then from 17 to 34, a reverence in the assembly. So I was thinking that this could be corrective ministry. I took it that there was insubordination of the sisters to the men, and in modesty of dress, I thought it was correct.
Well, I can see some would think of that now. I want to get moving.
One of the good objections to what you're teaching, what you have taught in your opening in this chapter, is that the headship of man implies the inferiority of women, and that's greatly opposed in the world and the so-called assembly circles in any area. And they say that passage can't be that. Headship does not mean authority at all, that kind of thing. It could make women appear. But our brother has said in the Godhead, God is the head of Christ, and there's no inferiority there.
No.
Headship
does not. No. Though it has really more to do with control than with superiority.
Oh, it has to do with superiority at all. Why, just the last question of verse 3, why the order? Why does he not say the head of the woman is the man, the head of the man is Christ, the head of Christ is God? Why does he start with the middle one, the head of the man is Christ, and then go to the lower disused?
I know, that is a problem, all right. And most likely, he's wanting to emphasize the importance to the brethren at Corinth that they are to be submissive to the Lord, and that's the prominent one, and he gives it first place. I may be wrong on that, but that may be it right now. Now we must move on. Right, give it quick now.
I thought the problem was with women taking their liberty. The apostle's going to have to emphasize that man is the head. But before he gives man that position, he let the sisters know that the man also has a head.
Mm-hmm.
It's not autocratic, neither is it absolute. Man's headship is relative to Christ.
Now, we'll have to go to verse 5. With the head uncovered, dishonoreth her head. Now you see, verse 4, every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head. Not as he's failing to take in display with a symbol. He's failing to display the headship that God has given him, so therefore he's dishonoring his head. His own head. Then in...
I think perhaps some of us see that perhaps in a wider...
No, that, I can't have that now, because when you get to the women now, you can't get the fact that when a woman is shaming, she's not shaming man, she's shaming herself.
Well, that's how you would view it. I personally see it... I still see a metaphorical headship coming in, dishonouring. But when... if a man prays or prophesies with his head covered, he dishonors his head, which is Christ.
I don't think so.
I was going to suggest that he deals with the man first. And I would link verse 7 with verse 4. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God. That's why he doesn't cover his head. But the woman is the glory, she's not the image, she's never the representative of the man, she is the glory of the man. So the man uncovers his head because he's the image, he's the representative, and the woman, she covers her head because she is the glory of the man. Now that's the explanation of why the head is covered and why the head is not covered.
So are you seeing headship here, the head, as being metaphorical, then?
I do.
You do?
I do.
The second head is much before him.
Yes, and I think that's made clear in verse 7, and verse 5 links with verse 6. It's denying an order that God has established in headship.
I think he establishes the principle in verse 3, and then he's illustrating it as he goes down the verses.
When Paul is speaking in any way like this, his head, if it's in any doubt, he would add, as he did in Ephesians, even Christ. But he didn't do it here, because he's not thinking of the symbolic thing, he's thinking of the man's own head.
So, Monsieur, I ask you therefore, in what way would you share the
fact? Yes, because a man's failing to take the gloried position that God has given him as with his bare head and displaying the dignity that God has put upon him.
Well, that would not be obvious, would it? Not back again to verse 3.
Would that not be obvious?
In what way did the woman shave her head? Would that be an obvious thing?
Sure. You mean, what do you see? When a woman would be taking the place of a man, well, that's what she would do.
Yes. What I'm saying is that
she's displaying a place that she never had.
Why is verse 3 then? Is it not linked with verse 3 at all then? Really, you're starting off in verse 4 then.
I thought
the principle has already been established in verse 3, and the outcome of that principle, therefore, is seen in verse number 4. I thought.
I don't see that, because if a woman prays or prophecies with her head uncovered, she's taking the place of man, and she's acting in a shameful manner. Now he links that with as if her head were shaven or shorn, showing us that there's a marks of disgrace upon her. Now she doesn't disgrace man; she disgraces herself with her head. As her head is her head, and his head is his head.
Mr. McShane, don't we have the both here? No, not sitting up on the fence. You know that I don't do that.
Not comfortable.
But, don't you think, it's not comfortable. Don't you think that the literal head is here, but there is a deeper meaning that we must not miss? And he does dishonor his head because he is placing upon it the symbol of subjection. He's shaving his own head. But in so doing, he's also dishonoring Christ, because he's the representative, and in that way, he's dishonoring Christ.
I don't see.
I feel that we are both.
I know. I know we've tried that, but I don't see it. Brother, you know where I stand anyhow. And it's, to me, when you get to the women, that ends that, puts that out of it all.
A woman shames herself, she doesn't shame man.
Well, we'll move on, yes. Now, it is with the question of hair, because if she has already, her natural veil, as we would say, or not your hair, covering, then it's a small matter for her to answer that the outer covering.
That is confirmed in fact that she's been her cover, that is, she hasn't her hair on the level she was off.
No. Well, God has found delight and pleasure in the creature that he made, man. Now, he made him in his own image, and that, of course, added to his pleasure in him. Now, a woman was made for man, and therefore she is his glory in the sense that he appreciates her. Because, and that goes on to argue that God provided Adam with a wife. That was really his delight and joy and glory.
Isn't the leading thought in glory that of manifestation? I mean, the difference, we've got man being the image and glory of God. So it's not likeness, it's image, isn't it? In other words, that's representation.
Yes.
Whereas glory is manifestation.
Yes, but there's an exhibiting of God's glory in man, because he's God's handiwork. Is that what you're thinking about? Or that he's the masterpiece of God's making? Is that what you're thinking about?
Well, we're talking actually about man and not mankind.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, God in making man has an object that he can glory in. But I had thought that in man obtaining a woman, he has an object in which he can glory.
You see, I take it that as far as God is concerned, his authority, if we're thinking of his authority, that authority must be unchallenged. And if we're thinking of his glory, then that glory mustn't be hid. It must be manifested. And therefore you have this order of the covering of the woman, but not the covering of the man.
I don't see I don't see that the woman should be covered because she's the glory of God and the glory of God is the head.
No.
I think that's a misunderstanding. That's different. Mm-hmm. I reckon in this section, in the previous verses, the woman has to put upon headship. Mm-hmm. Man doesn't cover because he's the head. The woman doesn't cover because he's the head. The emphasis in this passage is not upon two different spheres, it's upon two different glory. That God did man, he got in the glory of
intent. But he made woman deserve the glory of husband. He had headship, she had eldership. Now, St. Paul, in position of headship, is part of man's design to go to the active with his head on top, because he's head, the woman, because she's submissive and have her glory is to be complementary. Man's glory was to be representative. Woman's glory was to be complementary. So she steps out of the helpership position. It's grace. If he steps out of the headship position, it's a disgrace, because both of them have left the distinctive glory that God created for them and assigned for each one.
Well, we'll have to get on, Brother.
Why is the authority over the head linked with the angels?
That's an unanswered question. I had thought that in my own simple way, I thought that angels were witnesses of God's creatorial work and rejoiced when they saw it done. And it would be anything that would be contrary to that would be startling to their view and would certainly not be in keeping with what they expected to see. That's all I can see.
The authority on the head enlarged on that a little part of the tree. The authority on the head.
Oh, on her head. Well, I have thought that it's really the symbol. It's really the symbol that she's wearing of her submission to the authority of man, not to her own authority. I know quite a number have said that this is the great authority of women to wear a head covering, that gives them authority and power, but I didn't take that view. I take the view that she wears the symbol just because she is under authority, and that's all I can see in it.
Isn't it nice to see, though, that in a disorderly world, angels behold the scene that acknowledges the order of God's system. I thought that was amazing. And with the head covered, the woman is that take the place that God has given her in the creation, the order of creation.
Yes. Now, I think we should say that he corrects things in a certain way. And that is to say, we mustn't think lightly of women because they're both alike in the Lord. That is, whether a man or a woman, both are one in the Lord, and they both have relationships with the Lord, very precious indeed. And then secondly, he lets us see that while women were made for men, at least the woman was made for man, he also lets us see that a woman's not only a man's wife, but also a man's mother. Because there'd be no men if there were no women, if you know what I mean, in production, so that he owes his existence to his mother. So he levels the thing up as best he can without interfering at all with the question of headship. Now, we want us to see that he then, in verse 14, he moves out into what we might call what is seemly or becoming in the world, or what he calls nature here. That's a very difficult word, as you know. It's not an inward thing at all, I think, in the passage. It's just that as they looked on men in general, it was common, it was normal for men to have, it would be a shame for men to have long hair and women to have her shorn. Now, verse 15 shows that if she's quite happy to have her, not your glory, her hair, as a wrapper or whatever word you like to use, it's really the word for cloak in Hebrews chapter 1, isn't that right? Keep me right, man. And it's used also in Ezekiel and so on. It has to do with cloak. That is, the hair is a covering already. Then for her to add an extra one to that's no great asking her to do something unreasonable. It's quite in keeping with what's already her portion. Now I think that covers it up. But if a man seek to be contentious, now I have thought the contention was to do with this matter. We have some of them here today and have been contentious. We have no such custom, nor the churches of God. Don't take that too serious, brother.
One difficulty here, of course, is that we must be thinking in terms of the vial. You see what
yes,
I mean?
Yes,
therefore, it might be in keeping there for a woman. It would be in order for a woman to have her hair long and long over her shoulders and yet wear a veil so that when it came to the assembly, her hair, which is her own glory, would be covered, would be veiled. But of course, you know, we've got this different setup now. We think that we have to do away with the veil and have, you know, hats. But it is the veil. I mean, I think we need to keep that in
well, I know that you don't want to push it too strongly.
Could I just say, without being contentious, when we come to the woman's long hair, it's the word for long hair here, and I know that it occurs in words, it's a different word, but only it occurs again in Hebrews chapter 1, I understand, that here it is, as you say, a wraparound, but it's in relation to her head and her shoulders, that this is a covering, and that shows the divine order in creation of the man's headship and the woman's place of helpmeet. And I judge that that's the glory that our brother Gilliland was referring to, so that there is a reference even to headship here. And a different word is used, at least I judge a different word is used, in order to differentiate between that temporary covering and that which is permanent. God has given us that permanent covering in the divine order in creation, then the Christian woman should willingly take the temporary covering which is among her.
No, we must go away, Brian, because I'm very sorry now, but really, I don't know how we're going to do this chapter now. I'm getting this half of the time away.
Can I ask you through your
I don't want to cause any offense. I think it would be in keeping for a woman to have her hair covered, because if she is displaying her hair, particularly in the assembly context, that then she's displaying her glory, and neither her glory nor the man's glory should be manifest in the assembly.
Well, that's that one.
You're misunderstanding the passage. You forgive us and lead you into that position. If the woman must be covered because she's the glory of man, and she must be covered to hide man's glory, if that is true, I think it will definitely not. But if that is true, then she must also cover her hair completely, because her hair is her glory. And then she would have her own glory on display. Covering the man's glory, and then her own glory on display.
That's what I said.
Which would be inconsistent.
I said.
I know when the sister covers her head, she's not covering the man's glory, she's actually expressing her own glory. And that helped me.
Yes. But I don't believe you got me wrong. I said I felt that her hair should be covered.
That's what I said.
I think the very opposite. I think her hair should be...